Thank you for listening to Issues Etc., and thanks to all of you who have chipped in to help support the show. Listener contributions are the reason we can do this, so thanks.
Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be spending 3 hours here broadcasting from a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar here at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. We're up here broadcasting both today and tomorrow live. We are coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 25th of June. And we'll be spending these 3 hours with three guests who are either attendees or speakers at this Worldview Conference. In the first hour, we'll be talking with State Senator Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota about postmodernism and education. How has the postmodern worldview found its way into the classroom where your children go to school? That's the first hour of the program. In the second hour of the program, we'll talk with Dr. Angus Manoj, a regular guest here on Issues Etc., about Christianity and culture. Where does the balance exist, if one exists at all, between Christianity and the culture? How do they interact with one another? Does Scripture have to say anything about that? We'll find out in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, Professor Alan Quist, who's professor of political science at Bethany Lutheran College and one of the presenters here at the Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, will talk with him about the national political scene. Just go across the landscape politically. We'll be talking about domestic affairs, we'll be talking about foreign affairs, we'll be talking about the Mideast, about the life issues, and we'll start out that third hour of the program getting his assessment of the first 2 years of the Bush presidency here on Issues Etc. State Senator Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota is our first guest here on Issues Etc. Senator Bachmann, welcome.
Todd, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
I must ask, because this is probably the most curious question you get asked often, knowing that you work as a senator in the state of Minnesota, what was it like working with former Governor Jesse Ventura?
Well, I think it would probably shock listeners to learn that the governor really didn't work with the legislature very much. Frankly, we just didn't see him. He wasn't here. You saw him more on Jay Leno. As a matter of fact, I saw him more on Jay Leno than I saw him in the Capitol.
As a governor, I mean, there was a lot of suspicion that a former wrestler was more of a novelty governorship. What was your impression of his term in office?
He had one term, which was for 4 years, and I believe he came in actually as a fairly conservative fellow. That's the way he sounds, but as he acted out his role as governor, it seemed more and more that he had less to do with the actual governing, and his staff, it seemed, had more to do with the actual governing. He spent a lot of his time, frankly, out in Hollywood, in New York City, doing interviews, writing a book, writing a musical. And so he was very involved with his career, I would say, as opposed to maybe attending to the home fires.
Were any political milestones passed during Governor Ventura's four-year term? Major changes in the state of Minnesota?
Well, we did have a 26% increase in spending during those years. That's a phenomenal increase in spending in our overall state budget. So we did increase spending quite a bit, and there were numerous additional regulations that were added. But I would say primarily it's in the area of growth of government. We grew quite a bit.
How did you become involved in state politics?
Well, my background is I'm a tax litigation attorney, and I'm also a mother. And so my husband and I have 5 children, and I became involved in politics simply because I started reading about what was happening in our local public schools. My husband and I belong to a Wisconsin Lutheran Synod church, and our children are in private Lutheran school, but we have foster children in our home. We have 5 biological children, but we've had over about 25 foster children live in our home. By law, all of our foster children have to be in the public schools. I began to read about the new curriculum that was coming in our public schools and the new federal education laws that were impacting our foster children, and I was very concerned about the laws that were happening, and so I started paying a little bit more attention.
Now, that's got to be a daunting task. I mean, to have 5 children and a husband, and to spend time in the state Senate. How much of that time does it take? Is it a full-time job?
It's more than a full-time job, but for part of the year. And for me, since April 1st of 2000, when I first received endorsement to run for the Minnesota Senate, I haven't stopped since then. So I've been full-time since then. But normally now, we've just concluded our session for the year. And so I took this week off now to come to this confessional worldview seminar just to get a little break. So hopefully now we'll see a little rest.
How tempting is it to compromise? I think Minnesota has the reputation, although it sits squarely in the Midwest, of being a rather liberal state. How tempting is it once you are elected?
That's an understatement, Todd.
Okay. Well, once you're elected to office and go first to the Senate chamber, how tempting is it to compromise with the prevailing view of the legislature in a state like Minnesota?
I am so glad that you asked that question, because it is extremely tempting. Not only is it tempting, that's the expectation. If any of your listeners have ever experienced an ocean wave, that's kind of how it feels, because it's a completely separate culture once you're inside of the Capitol, because no longer is a legislator surrounded by what I would call, quote, real people, real taxpayers, real mom and dads. You're surrounded by your fellow legislators, almost all bureaucrats who've been there forever, lifetime people whose lives are to build and promote bigger and bigger government, but also special interest paid lobbyists. And that's who talks to us all day, not, quote, the real people who voted for us and sent us there.
So your peer group changes when you go into politics.
People that we spend our time with. Yes. Mm-hmm. Once we take the oath of office and we're at the Capitol, I can just tell you from personal experience that instead of being, as a legislator, I went from being with the people all the time to now being inside the walls of government all the time. And so I just heard from all the voices that wanted bigger government, more money, and build this whole process bigger and bigger, the realm of the state.
Is it your perception that, and do you have a certain sympathy, especially on the national level, when you see people who seem to be so promising as candidates for office, when they get to Washington or when they get to their state house, to suddenly start to break the promises they had made under these very kinds mm-hmm. of pressures?
Oh, without a doubt. And I think what I would say, Todd, to the listeners is that an individual has to know why they're going to serve in public office in the first place. They have to know why they're going. And number two, they have to know what they believe. And number three, they have to recognize how closely will they retain allegiance to those beliefs once they get into office. That's not only a huge temptation, but it's a huge commitment. And I think I learned as a believer in the Bible and in the truth of what the Bible says, I learned as an ordinary person entering public life the biblical admonition to pray for those who are in authority. Because when people are in authority, generally speaking, most people want to do the right thing as legislators, but the pulls and the pressures that are on legislators are literally more than a human can bear, and we need to have the prayers of the people so that we are able to have a divine sense, if you will, of being able to hold on to the essence of our convictions. It's a tough road, not an impossible road. Mm-hmm. Because it's a calling. I saw this as something that the Lord had called me to do, and I was faithful in following that calling. But it's a difficult job, just like a pastor is called to his position. But it's something that requires, I think, faithful prayer on the part of the saints. That's not to say that we can't deliver on our convictions. I've had to take extremely unpopular positions. I've had to be one voice against every other voice in the Minnesota Senate to stand against a measure, but I've been willing to do that because I believe before God that was what I had to do.
Someone might be saying, look, politics is dirty business no matter how you cut it. Whether you have convictions or not, it's still dirty business. And for a Christian, a confessing Christian, to go into politics would simply require too much compromise, and it can't be done. How would you respond to that?
Oh, you know, I think just the opposite. all of life is dirty business. You know, we are born in original sin and we live in a fallen world. So it doesn't matter where we go to live out the calling that's been put on our heart. It's a dirty business wherever you go. The great thing about going to serve as a legislator is one has the opportunity to see the evidence of original sin all around you, because the worst in human nature comes out in this arena. And this is an opportunity to bring redemption into this arena and to speak truth to power. I love this opportunity. I'm not there, Todd, to get reelected and reelected and reelected and make this a lifetime career. That's not my goal. My goal is to come and bring a certain voice to bear on whatever time that the Lord allows me to serve in that position in the Senate.
Is it true that once you make your views, your convictions, and your position known in a place like a Senate chamber, are you, even as one of the members of the Senate, labeled, put into a kind of a pigeonhole, and then they pretty much decide where you stand, and that's how they deal with you from that point on?
Well, that certainly can be, absolutely. But a person is going to get labeled no matter what they stand and say. Someone may be labeled as a milquetoast. Someone may be labeled as someone who can be easily rolled on an issue. And I think, if anything, I feel personally that I've been able to garner a certain level of respect among my colleagues, because when I stand up and make an argument for a position, I don't necessarily appeal on the basis of Scripture. I'll appeal on the basis of a biblical principle. So I'll take a principle, for instance. Let's just say it's dealing with honesty, here's a real example: parental authority. Scripture says that it's the parent's role to raise up and train a child in the way he will go. Now, we're seeing currently that the state wants to take more and more control over a parent's children. So I appeal on the basis of parental authority. So I bring biblical principle to bear in the course of the public debate. I don't necessarily cite Proverbs such and such, but I use biblical principle. And we know that biblical principle is truth. And truth has a wonderful tendency to resonate a chord of recognition in people's hearts. And that's what I try to appeal to.
We're spending some time talking in this first hour of Issues, Etc., with State Senator Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, not only talking about politics in general, but we're going to turn our conversation toward the issue of postmodernism and how it has found its way into the classroom, into education. Define postmodernism as you have come to know it via your time as not only as a mother and a wife, but also as someone who serves as a representative of the people, elected representative.
Sure. Postmodernism is a concept, a new philosophy, if you will. We've heard of the philosophy of humanism, which means that man is the center of all things, and so our decisions are based not on appealing to a supernatural authority, such as the Bible, an eternal truthful authority, but just on the basis of what man wants at any given time. That's humanism. Postmodernism goes one step beyond humanism. And it says that there is no final authority. Man isn't even a final authority. Reality is what I want it to be. I construct my own reality. Now, this is kind of a bizarre idea, but this is the new philosophy that's permeating not only education, not only textbooks, but our entire culture. It's called social construct. Each person makes up their own truth and their own reality. And there is nothing new under the sun, because the Bible speaks of this in the end of the book of Judges, when it says, "And every man did that which was right in his own eyes." In some sense, that is what postmodernism is. Every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. There is no ultimate authority that can be appealed to, and it isn't just a universal man-centered authority, but it's a personal authority where I make up my own truth. My truth may not be your truth.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with State Senator Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota. Senator, before we go on to education, do you actually hear your fellow lawmakers, lobbyists, people who you work with in the state legislature, saying things like, "Well, I have my truth, you have your truth," or there are no absolutes. Do you hear those kind of things, postmodernism raising its head in your daily work?
Without a doubt. I'll give you one example. We were dealing with an education committee with sex ed curriculum, and one legislator in our state, the first Hmong legislator in the United States, brought about a bill to take our law reads that we will teach abstinence until marriage in our sex ed curriculum. And this legislator wanted to strike two words, until marriage. And the reason why she wanted to strike that we would be teaching abstinence until marriage is because she said, well, that's not true for everyone. Because your truth may be that you believe that people should be abstinent until marriage, but not everyone does. Our society has changed, she said, and so we need to strike the words until marriage.
So in other words, it sounds as though she was saying, because people disagree with abstinence until marriage,
we'll adopt hedonism. In essence, that's what she's saying, that we will not have a standard. And the Bible presents a standard to which everyone can repair. Whether you're a believer or not, it's a wonderful standard, a glue that holds society together. We've found just from history that the Bible offers a marvelous standard. This new way of thinking offers no standard, none whatsoever. And if you go with that logic, ultimately, Todd, you'd have to say the law itself isn't worth having, because the law itself represents a standard, so it's absurd to even have law.
Well, for instance,
I know this is bizarre thinking, because to you and I it is bizarre. I shouldn't speak for you, but I don't adopt that. Most rational thinking people don't adopt that. We have to follow certain laws, otherwise society would fall apart and a chaos would ensue.
We were driving up here yesterday afternoon. The speed limit said, at various points, 65. Now, if I used the logic proposed by your fellow lawmaker,
that's right,
I would say, now look, 65 is a fine standard for the guy in the car behind me, but that's not true for me. My standard might be something like 85, as fast as I can make the car go because I'm in a hurry to get up
perfect
to Trago.
Perfect example. Perfect.
I could really argue against any law, any regulation, any rule whatsoever based upon that logic.
That's right. As a matter of fact, think about an architect that builds houses or office buildings based on that philosophy, that there is no actual truth, no right or wrong, no straight or narrow. Would you want to trust living in a home that's built on those standards? Better yet, would you want to trust getting in an airplane that's built on those standards? It's just not reality. Postmodernism absolutely conforms in no way to our human experience. Postmodernism is a fantasy that's been ascribed to by people who are desperate to look for anything that will deny the truths of the Bible.
So I'm just curious, did the logic of this fellow senator hold the day in the debate over whether or not abstinence should be taught until marriage?
Well, unfortunately, her view did hold the day, and I was not able to persuade my fellow legislators on that regard in the Senate. Now, however, the House of Representatives took a different view, and that ultimately did not become law in Minnesota. So I'm happy to say that, but the Minnesota Senate is dominated by a very radical core group of people, and it did pass in that chamber.
Let's talk about another example of postmodernism finding its way not only into our daily lives, but even into our legislative lives, and that has to do with education. Tell us the story of this education bill that was proposed before your legislative body and what it was about, where you saw in it postmodernism.
I think you would be speaking of the profile of learning, and this is actually federal legislation that came down in 1994 called Goals 2000. And it was pushing what was called a standards movement across the nation. Your listeners all over the country, no matter what state they live in, have been impacted by this federal law. This applies to everyone. 1994 Federal Goals 2000 legislation was passed, which said that all states should follow federal standards. All 50 states took voluntarily federal money, and they imposed these standards. What the standards were based on were national standards, no longer local. Most people understand that the local school classroom has just been that. It's been locally controlled. This is a whole new thing in the 225-year history of our nation. We've never had the federal government controlling our classrooms until today. So Minnesota adopted this federal standard called Goals 2000, which is the federal curriculum, and I mean the content that your children learn, and put that into place. The essence of this curriculum is postmodern in that children are taught to construct their own meaning and to find their own understanding on different topics, whether it's science or history. They're to make up their own knowledge. This is bizarre. How do you test that? But that's the essence of the new curriculum.
So, in other words, there was a federal standard for actual public school curriculum handed down, specific enough.
That's right.
That you could look at it and say, this is what the federal government is mandating be taught in our Minnesota schools.
Without a doubt. As a matter of fact, I would encourage your listeners to go to the Federal Department of Education website, and they will be listing the national education organizations that have written the federal curriculum. Among those are the National Council on Social Studies Standards, the National Council of Economic Standards, we have National Math Standards, National English Language Standards, National Geography Standards. You can go and read these online now. They're available. This is not hidden. It's all been put out online, and we just heard a lecture, and you'll be speaking with Professor Quist later, and he was itemizing some of these standards. For instance, the National History Standards and the National Science Standards now mandate that our children be taught evolution, Darwinian evolution. That's now a federal mandate that's no longer a local school choice.
Like what you hear? Please support this worldwide outreach with a tax-deductible contribution today.
What is a parent to do, Senator, when they realize that as they look through the textbooks, as I have several times through my kids' textbooks, they go to parochial school, but I am still a little alarmed at what is taught in the science curriculum. I find things not only that seem to have a very strong bent towards, say, evolution, but I also find a method of teaching that jumps from one subject to another, that doesn't stay on one subject.
No,
in teaching on history, they, rather than just talk about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, they will relate it to the environment, they're related to civil rights legislation in the 60s. It's all over the place,
because they're teaching from a theme, not from a subject.
Why is that? Explain this to us.
Well, because subject matter would indicate that we are transferring a body of knowledge from one generation to the next. And remember, that's no longer the purpose of education, to transfer knowledge, facts, and information. The new purpose of education is to transfer a worldview perspective or attitudes, values, and beliefs of this new postmodern worldview that rejects ultimate truth and instead accepts a relativistic personal philosophy of life that says whatever my truth is, that's truth for the moment. So what a parent needs to do is, number one, they have to know the truth. They have to know and understand the scriptural truths of the Bible. And a parent's first responsibility is to their children. You said your children are in parochial school. Our five biological children are also in parochial school. But we have found that our school uses textbooks that are based on the national standards, which are filled with postmodernism. So we have to protect our children by making sure they first know biblical truth. And then we have to make sure, number one, I would recommend for all parents, make sure your child knows how to read. There's no better way to teach a child how to read than through phonics. One great program is actually created out of St. Louis, Missouri. It's called Turbo Reader. And a person can get that through Phyllis Schlafly, who's with the Eagle Forum down in St. Louis, Missouri. But make sure your child knows how to read. Number two, don't allow your child to take tests in school that are not subject matter related. There's a lot of personal invasive test questions right now that are being asked, and don't allow your child to be a part of that. Also, as a parent, ask to see your child's curriculum. You would examine your child's textbooks. Too few parents do that. They just trust the experts. They just trust the schools, and parents have to get involved and see what it is that their child is learning. The other thing I would recommend is there's a tremendous national organization that parents should write this website down and go and visit. It's called edwatch.org. That's edwatch.org. Very simple, edwatch.org. go there. You can go on a regular email update, and they are the best, finest source of information I've found. And you and I have been talking now about postmodern education. You're going to have one of your guests on, Professor Alan Quist, I understand, later in the day. And I would highly recommend, I have a copy of his book in my lap, Fed Ed. It explains this new federal curriculum and how it's enforced. And I believe if people go to the edwatch.org website, they could pick up a copy of this book. It's an excellent primer on postmodernism in education today.
So you are saying that there has been a real shift, not only in what is being taught, but why the things that are being taught are being taught.
Without a doubt.
You said it's now the goal to pass on values, beliefs, and attitudes rather than facts, information, and kind of what we would call objective truth.
That's right. That's right. That is the change. In some ways, you might say, Todd, that it's a disrespect of the intellect, because formerly we respected the intellectual choices, diversity, if you will. True intellectual diversity was respected in our nation. People could come to different conclusions. No longer, under the current system that's being taught, there's an expectation of conformity of belief with the ultimate dissemination of subject matter or with the content of curriculum. That's frightening. That's a First Amendment problem that we have never encountered before in this nation. People need to recognize that. And I would say for your listeners, go and take a look at your state teacher licensure rules. Ours were dramatically changed in Minnesota from 13 pages to 257 pages. Our teachers now are required to subscribe to a belief system that is postmodern in nature, and our children also on their testing are expected to demonstrate agreement with politically correct biases. This is dangerous, and especially for confessional Christians who have a creed that they see as their belief system. And if you will, the new national standards is the new confessional curriculum for the postmodern worldview. That's dangerous stuff for a Bible-believing Christian.
So is this why, when I was helping my 11-year-old daughter with her science homework near the end of this last school year, and as I said, it's a parochial school, but the textbook comes from the same companies, mm-hmm. When they were teaching the physics section, and they were talking about acceleration, and they were talking about deceleration, the basic facts of physics, there was a little sidebar right there in the textbook on the misuse of fossil fuels and how this is going to lead to global warming. And, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking to myself, this really has nothing to do with the subject matter at
hand. That's right. That's right. It's a worldview that's being promoted. And we just heard a lecture by Professor Quist talking about this is pantheism. What we're seeing is pantheism being taught, that all of nature is God and that we are one with nature. My little daughter, as a matter of fact, in her parochial school, was taught that if she turns the lights off, that she has just saved a polar bear by doing that. And I was surprised, and I said, Sophia, where did you learn that? And she explained from her scholastic curriculum that is being used in our parochial school. So we have to do a certain amount of de-brainwashing when the children come home.
You know, I thought it was bad for me because I was raised in the era of education when phonics was not the method for teaching children mm-hmm. how to read. It was the see and say. I was never taught grammar until
whole language method.
I was not taught English grammar until I actually got into college and had to take Greek and Hebrew as a pre-seminary student, and I had to learn the grammar then, and it was a daunting task, I'll tell you that much. Writing was not even an art or a discipline. It was purely a creative endeavor. We were encouraged to be as creative as possible. It didn't make any difference whether I could spell, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I'm still struggling with the whole spelling issue as well. But it sounds as though my children now, the next generation coming through the public school curriculum, have to deal not only with that, but also with the fact that even the things I was being taught, like history, are no longer really being taught to the same end.
You're exactly right, because the so-called standards movement that is being imposed on all the states now is a reaction to the lack of standards. What you just described, Todd, with your educational background, was the lack of standards movement, which was the relativism, you know, all values, clarification, all things were relative and loosey-goosey. And so now we saw what a disaster that was, that, voila, why did the SAT scores drop 80 points, and why did they continue to drop, and why is it that we have, that our cash registers, not McDonald's, have pictures on the cash registers as opposed to dollar amounts because kids can't make change anymore. We saw that's what led to this new imposed standards movement. But instead of putting subject matter curriculum back in the schools, we put a philosophy back in the schools, something that we've never had before, in that bias has always been a part of textbooks, liberal bias. We've seen that for years. We've known that. What's different now is that students must demonstrate on their tests that they believe in conformity with those biases. That's what's new.
Are they being graded on their willingness to express that conformity?
Oh, without a doubt. Not only at the local level, but at the national level. All students now are required. The new game in town now, Todd, is called No Child Left Behind. That's the new federal education bill that covers all children in all public schools. And No Child Left Behind mandates that all children take a national test, which is the NAEP test, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Now, interestingly, the NAEP test is not allowed to be shown to the public. If a question is shown to the public, a person would be subject to a felony. I mean, get this, it's a felony for someone to expose a test question to the public. That's stated right in the federal law. So the test questions themselves are open-ended, and they ask for responses that will demonstrate conformity with the postmodern worldview.
It is kind of shocking stuff, folks, when you see...
I can say that. I'm sorry, Todd. I can say that because I have seen a copy of the test. I wasn't supposed to have it, but a mother gave me a copy of the test, and I saw it for myself. Two-thirds of the questions on the national NAEP test that children take, it deals with personal, invasive questions about the child's home, their background, what goes on in their home, about their attitudes, values, and beliefs. Only one-third is even academic. And of those one-third questions, many of them deal with radical environmentalism and political correct topic. Very few are actually asking questions about academic achievement and assessing that achievement.
The kind of thing that shocks about this really... why should it shock us? Because this is the direction that we seem to be headed in almost every endeavor. But I guess the thing that shocks about it is the fact that this is happening in the classrooms where our children sit for about 8 months every year as well. We're talking about postmodernism and education. We are coming to you live this Wednesday, June the 25th, from the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin, a confessional Christian worldview seminar. Our guest in this hour for about the next 10 minutes is State Senator Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, and we are talking about postmodernism and education.
You know, Todd, I think that your listeners should be absolutely outraged by what they're hearing, because for most states, the K-12 education budget is the number one budget item for their state. So if nothing else, from an economic point of view, people's tax dollars are being increased and spent in order to disseminate a new religion, if you will, on the public school place. And we hear all the time about separation of church and state and how we shouldn't have Bibles in the school and we shouldn't have prayer in the school. Well, I'm here to tell you, there is a new religion being taught in our schools, and it is antithetical to the Christian religion.
Now, how do you define that then? How do you make a statement like, this is a new religion? Someone's going to look at this curriculum,
sure,
and say, yeah, it's a philosophy. It's definitely a worldview. But I wouldn't go so far as to call it a religion.
Well, it's a religion if it demands conformity of belief. There is a stated system of belief, and there is ultimately an allegiance that is required in this system. And the allegiance primarily is to the state, but it's surrendering a belief system to whatever the state has decided the ultimate belief system would be. Part of that rendering is to give up one's individual rights under the Bill of Rights. Now, this may seem bizarre, but I encourage your listeners, go to the website. It's called the Center for Civics Education. They've written the new civics curriculum. I've read it myself. I've seen the textbook. And the very front of the book, interestingly, says, Even though this is a book about our nation's history, it says this book is not, the purpose of this book, of this textbook, is not to fill your head with a lot of facts and information about America's history. This is our national civics textbook. Well, what's the purpose then? The purpose is to alter our thinking and our allegiance, because the final conclusion of this new federal textbook is that we're to move away from national sovereignty, American sovereignty, and start thinking about world government and becoming global citizens.
Our phone numbers.
This is financed with federal and state tax dollars.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from her car, Sally is on the line. Sally, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. This is Sally in St. Louis.
Hi, Sally. What's your question?
I wanted to thank your caller. She's been really awesome. And I am outraged and, frankly, scared to death. But I wanted her to talk a little bit about the thing I noticed, even the parochial schools, memorization is something also that seems that is not done or discouraged at this point. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks a lot, Sally. What about memorization? Even when I was going through the school system, we still had to memorize the times tables and the state capitals and even as a young child, the alphabet.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that's one thing that really caused the hair on the back of my neck to stand up when I first started examining this. In our local elementary school, children are not taught to memorize the multiplication tables. Now, how in the world do you progress through mathematics if you're told you will not be memorizing the mathematical tables? It's derided memorization. It's called drill and kill. And it's very popular among professionals in the education community to deride memorization. But just the opposite, as we usually find, is the case. In fact, the world's greatest inventor, it's a Japanese man, I can't pronounce his name for you, but he invented the CD and all sorts of items that we use today. He said the greatest indicator of genius is how much time is spent in memorization prior to the age of 21. And we should be having our children memorize as much as they possibly can. Now, some children are just not prone to be able to memorize. It's very difficult for them. But for many children, it's possible. And we start while they're young. We start with songs. We start with scripture memory, with catechism. Start when they're young, and then they can memorize portions of, let's say, the Gettysburg Address or, you know, famous things. And this stays with a child their entire life. If they learn scripture when they're young, it will be with them forever. I know from personal experience now, being a little older myself, that it's much more difficult to memorize the older that you are. It just doesn't seem to stick. But for children, we rob them of their future if we don't teach them to memorize important things when they're young.
Perhaps the greatest concern of parents of young children and of high school age children as well, with regard to the public school curriculum, is the sex education curriculum. Mm-hmm. What does the Goals 2000, as you said, introduced in 1994, what does this federal standard for public school curriculum have to say about what's taught in what we used to call health class?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, that curriculum now begins at birth, if you can believe it. There are what's known as the federal NIAC standards. And those are the National Assessments for Young Children, the NIAC standards. Those are put in place in daycare centers and in federal child care centers all across the United States. Any states that have adopted the young children standards have only adopted NIAC standards. There are no other standards. And I will tell you this, the NIAC standards demand that anti-bias curriculum be taught. Well, that doesn't leave much to the imagination about how it's taught. I've read the books myself, and it is a pro-homosexuality curriculum. So sexuality is taught from a postmodern perspective, not that God made man and woman in his image, but that it's sexuality is merely a matter of preferences. And so we can prefer whatever form of sexual expression that we choose. So this is what children are taught from birth to age 5 under the national NIAC standards, and then kindergarten forward, it just continues on more of the same. But it's the philosophy that's more important than teaching the plumbing, because the philosophy says, Hey, the choice is yours. There's no external standard for you to appeal to. The choice is yours, and it's whatever preference you'd like to have.
Is there a practical way that you would recommend to someone who looks over these things as a lawmaker, for a parent who says, look, if it's only the sex ed curriculum that I'm concerned about, that's a big enough concern for me. How do I counter what my children seem to be being taught in their health class, which is not just more information than they need to know at too young an age, but that there is no right and wrong when it comes to how they live out their lives as sexual beings?
Sure. Well, I would suggest that parents have, just like Deuteronomy tells us, that parents are to talk with their children when they rise up in the morning, when they put them to bed at night, when they walk with them along the way. The Bible instructs parents, we are to be talking to our children all the time, staying in relationship with our children, and talking to them about their relationships with other people, what God's standard is for relationships, dating, marriage, child rearing. Let him see that modeled in our lives in a godly way, and then speaking about it. It's important to begin there on that personal relationship. That will do more than anything. But from there, we should ask our children and not presume that they just know biblical standards. We should ask them, do you believe that there is an ultimate truth? Do you believe that there is a final authority? I know a friend of mine just told me he heard on a Christian radio station this week, a nationally recognized Christian speaker said that in his most recent survey from 2002, 90% of American youth, including Christian, answered the question, is there any such thing as ultimate truth? They said no, that it's relative. In 1960, that figure was 30%. So I don't think that we should presume that our children ascribe to the same premises that you and I do. You and I may believe that there is an ultimate truth and that that truth is the Word of God. Our children may not have gotten that because everything in their culture tells them just the opposite. This isn't just a matter of bad textbooks. This is our culture now that's adopting a postmodern worldview.
Finally, with only about a minute before we have to close our conversation, we've been talking a lot about Goals 2000 introduced in 1994 and its shortcomings. It seems to be permeated with the postmodern philosophy, worldview, and, if you will, even kind of the faith of postmodernism. What would a good federal standard or a national standard for education curriculum look like to turn this around?
Well, we do have a national standard that is called No Child Left Behind, and it's imperative that your listeners know, Todd, that No Child Left Behind cements into place Goals 2000 and School to Work. It continues without missing a beat. My answer to your question, however, would be we need no federal standard in education. We had the finest education in America when all education was truly local, when local moms and dads decided on locally elected school boards what the local classroom should teach. That's when we had the highest standard and the greatest level of academic achievement. If we know that's what works, then why in the world are we going with a centrally managed system at the federal level? It's a huge mistake, and it's in violation of our national and state constitutions.
State Senator Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd.
We're broadcasting live from the Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar here at the Marvin M. Schwamm Retreat and Conference Center. The end of the first hour is upon us here. Folks, I had a seminary professor who said something very profound. In fact, he said a lot of very profound things, but among them was this. He said, you cannot understand what you do not know. You have to know something before you can understand it. Now, if for that reason alone your child goes to school and he is told that he doesn't need to know things, they're simply going to help him understand things without knowing them, be it mathematics or history. It should raise a red flag for us, because we can't understand what we don't know. We can't understand math until we understand our numbers and our times tables. These are simple things. But make no mistake about it, the national curriculum that is being recommended for your child's classroom is one that is about your child understanding something very specific, understanding the postmodern mind, understanding to think like a postmodern. The sad part of that is that To think like a postmodern is to abandon not only the things we know, but the things we understand as well, and to say it doesn't really matter anyway what we know or what we understand or what we believe. That way is the road to madness in the end, and it's not the road to educating our children either.
If you appreciate this Issues Etc. classic, please consider making a tax-deductible donation today. You can make a financial contribution by check, make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio, and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the difficult summer months.